For joining us. For me, it is delightful to be back at Torah for Tycoons, which is now 11 years old, Rabbi Shaw, is that
yes.
about right? And I remember because it was born around the same time as my daughter was. We had a speaker here from out of town. I was involved in the discussion about how to come to it, and the idea was when Rabbi Summers, Rabbi Schwab and I were talking, they said, oh, it was great we had this out-of-town speaker come in and brought this Torah to us. And they said, well, we have so much Torah wisdom here, we should have you present, get someone who's from a content, you know, with their own life and business to raise an issue and then get the Torah perspective as well. And thanks to the Harry Baron Trust, Rabbi Zev Baron and others, this has been sponsored for 11 seasons, and over 500 people in counting have been involved. You'll see that next month, we'll have Mark Cooper, and again, Rabbi Fleischer, a great topic about cloning. Ethical issues around biotechnology are fascinating and important. There's also a broader executive learning program. If you are so interested or inspired, the Kollel has lots of opportunities. Those of you who've never been to the Jewish Family Extravaganza, it is the best way to celebrate Christmas if you're in town. I would encourage folks to keep in mind. There is the Women's Wellness Workshop coming up in January 12th. And as per usual, we'll record this discussion like other Torah Tycoons, and they will be available for people to listen to. I get out of the way now, although I'll get back in when we have discussion. And it's my pleasure to introduce a good friend, Danny Sherwinter. He's now a partner at Marsh Fishman and Breifogel. He also teaches the University of Colorado Law School as an adjunct professor, very thoughtful about technology and Torah. And so when Rabbi Schwab asked me on this topic who was the right person, it was easy to recommend Danny, who came up from Boulder. And then, of course, Rabbi Fleischer, who's now the point person on this series and lots of other great educational programs. So, Rabbi, I think you go first or Danny goes first? Danny goes first. Okay.
All right. Well, so I thought I'd start by talking about what we're not going to talk about to kind of set the stage a little bit. In Japan, there's Shinto shrines are rebuilt every 20 years, plank by plank, and there's shrines that have been around for 1,200 years that have been rebuilt, you know, 60 some odd times, and when I heard about that, it reminded me of this classic paradox that people talk about. It was originally called the Ship of Theseus paradox. It's been called all kinds of things, the grandfather's axe paradox, all kinds of names. But basically, the paradox says, you know, is that shrine the same shrine that it was the first time, if it's been rebuilt completely from the start, or is it not? Is it a brand new shrine? The same way as Theseus's ship, the same ship as it was the first time if it was rebuilt plank by plank. And the question really comes down to, you know, what does it mean for it to be the same? And is there something about it that's greater than the pieces that make it up? And the way that applies to the artificial intelligence context that we're talking about today is that there's a similar issue with people. There's interesting research lately, or you know, in the last decade or so, that you know, your cells are replacing at something like 50 million cells per second or something like that. And some people have, you know, there have been headlines like, you know, are you really only 7 years old? Things like that. Are your lungs only 6 weeks old? Things like that. And you know, it's an interesting question. And so, to some extent, there's a question about are you more than the stuff that makes up you, and is there some idea of self? And there's this big philosophical question there. We don't want to have that conversation as part of this because that kind of derails the topic a bit, but I wanted to make sure to mention it so that it's explicit that we're not going to talk about that. And the reason that it's important is that in the Jewish context and in the context of halakha and of what we're going to talk about with Jewish law, you know, I think it's important just to acknowledge the fact that the premise is there is something more. So there is a soul. There is something that is above and beyond just those neurons firing in your brain, the stuff, the cells that are in your body, and that's sort of an important context by which to have this discussion. So the thing I'm supposed to really talk about is kind of a brief recap of the state of artificial intelligence, which I'll try to do quickly. I think we all kind of know what artificial means. It's not the real us, but something that is trying to sort of replicate what we are. Intelligence is really more of what people have focused on what does intelligence mean. I'll just say briefly that even the artificial part is getting more blurry because now there are a lot of circuits being made out of actual cells where they're actually programming cells to do certain things, in which case artificial becomes sort of a blurry line, including, you know, how this line continues to blur into next month's discussion on cloning of, you know, is a clone artificial or not, and that's its own discussion. As far as intelligence goes, the way that people have thought about intelligence in a computer context has changed a lot. So the sort of original older way that people thought about it was that you program a computer with what's called an ontology or a set of ontologies. So it's basically categories, definitions, and then you give it a way to infer from those things. So an example would be you program the computer to know, you know, as fact that all animals reproduce. And you program as fact a bear is an animal. And then the computer can figure out a bear reproduces. That's kind of what that older way is, and there was sort of a thought of, you know, to be as intelligent as a human would imply programming so many of these complex ideas into the computer that you would end up sort of approximating what a human knows. That switched a lot in the last few decades into the context of machine learning. And the idea of machine learning is instead of me training the computer with all this information, I'm going to tell the computer what things are good and bad. So I'm going to give it what's called a fitness function, and I'm going to tell it, if you keep trying and keep practicing and keep doing many, many, many iterations of the same thing, and you compare it against what I tell you is good or bad, then you can learn stuff. So if you think about the example of, let's say I want to throw something into a trash can across the room, right? So one way is you program the computer, measure the weight of this thing. Here's the physics associated with the trajectory from what you're going to do to where the thing is going to land. You know, all those kinds of parameters, and therefore this is how hard you must chuck that object in order for it to go into the computer. The other way to do it is to say, in the trash can is good, out of the trash can is bad, go. And then it just keeps trying, and maybe 1,000 times later it starts to figure out what is the right way to do it. And there's been a lot of variation of that. It's a complicated area, but I'll just mention sort of maybe three kinds of ways that comes up. So one is what's called genetic algorithms or evolutionary computation, and that's basically something where you say, like I said, you give it a fitness function and it sort of figures out what to do. A good example, a really interesting example of this, that's maybe not as obvious, one that people maybe don't think of as much, is a few years ago, NASA was trying to design a new antenna for a satellite. And they kept coming up with antenna designs, and the antenna designs were okay, but they weren't really doing exactly what they wanted. So instead, some people decided, well, let's just tell a computer what the antenna is supposed to do and see what it comes up with. And it did what's called genetic algorithms. So it took basically two designs and then sort of mated those designs and had a bunch of offspring. And then the ones that worked better got to mate, and the ones that worked worse died off. And then it kept doing that over many, many, many hundreds of thousands of generations. And it ended up with an antenna design that looked ridiculous. It was, you know, this crazy wire shape that worked better than anything anybody had ever come up with before. So it was an amazing success of genetic algorithms that shows that sometimes, you know, the fitness function is really a much better way than trying to presuppose what's the right result. Another example is another category is what's called fuzzy logic. So in the past, there's always been kind of this idea that computers work on ones and zeros. And now that's no longer really the case in a lot of systems. Now computers sort of have an idea of it's not hot or cold, it's some degree of warm. So, you know, you can kind of get the idea from things like there's the computer in your car that helps with fuel efficiency, things on your phone that do handwriting recognition and voice recognition. A lot of those are based on the idea that there's not sort of a right or a wrong, but there's sort of some level of this seems close enough or this seems better or worse than the last time. And then the last one is I already talked about. There's sort of these cellular circuits and things like that that have come up. So there's a lot of those kinds of things. The last thing I'll say before I turn it over is I want to give some examples. I was trying to think this morning of some examples of just some technologies that I've worked on in the last year or two. I'm a patent attorney, so things that I've sort of worked on patents for that use artificial intelligence. Some may be less obvious than others. I think people tend to think of artificial intelligence as, you know, some cyborg robot being, but really the way artificial intelligence comes up most of the time is in everyday things that we use all the time. One really good example is Siri or Google Now or Cortana or whatever operating system you're on is an amazing artificial intelligence engine, really incredible. If I'm, you know, if I say, if I'm on the highway and I say, how do I get to Eastside? It comes up with Eastside Kosher Deli and gives me the phone number. It doesn't come up with, you know, the east side of Kenya or something. You know, it knows what I'm trying to do because it's smart, quote unquote. Another one is virtual opponents in video games is huge. That's where a lot of development happens. There's purchase prediction and targeted advertisements. So anybody who's used Netflix or Amazon or anything else, and it says, oh, you might also like this, or oh, you've been looking at baby furniture. Now every time you pull up Google, it's going to give you 15 ads for baby furniture, that kind of thing. Another one is fraud detection. So anytime your bank has ever texted you or something and said, you know, hey, somebody's been using your card in this place, is that you? That's a huge artificial intelligence engine. And then the last one, which is actually really interesting that most people don't know happens, is a lot of things like Associated Press, Fox News, Wired News, Yahoo News, actually use artificial intelligence to write a lot of their articles. They get data from a lot of places, and the artificial intelligence engine actually writes the news article. So a lot of the articles, a lot of the at least simpler articles that you read on a lot of these news sources are not written by any human.
Who's putting the bias in?
Right. right. So anyway. So anyway, so this is all just to kind of say, you know, artificial intelligence comes up in a lot of places. It's not really just restricted to, you know, some super intelligent robot. But in the context of what we're about to talk about in these sources, really what we're kind of thinking about is going forward as these computers get more and more quote unquote intelligent, and you know, and you can program things to do actions, how does it affect halakhic discussions of, you know, when does something, you know, can something have kind of the intent of a human, can something have the halakhic impact of a human, you know, all those kinds of things. So that's where this all sort of runs into the halakhic issues.
That was a great great setup. Let me add two quick points for the rabbi. For those who aren't as deep in this world as Danny and I are, you should feel both excited and scared. So excited is the experience I had, which is a credit card fraud. The first purchase that was fraudulent was picked up, was not authorized, and they contacted me, and I said, no, I was not at State College, Pennsylvania's store. They just knew that was something I was unlikely to do because they knew my purchase patterns. So that's like a good outcome, right? Scary, the machines are taking over. They're going to infiltrate our lives more and more directly. And you have to almost start looking to science fiction. Anyone see the movie Minority Report?
Oh, yes.
So for those who didn't, I'm not going to give away too much, but they had eye recognition technology, which now exists. And you know how people would defeat it?
Yeah, they take their eyeball off.
Take your eyeballs out. Do you have to remove your eyeballs, have an implant so you could actually, you know, not be surveyed constantly. So the infiltration of our lives is happening, and how do we feel about this?
I'm not going to answer that question today. I can tell you how I feel about it. I will say, as Danny was speaking, I leaned over to Phil as he was talking about this, and I said, "This is terrifying." So that's my knee jerk reaction.
More terrifying than creating
terrifying.
A golem.
We're going to talk about the golem now.
Good.
So let's see. I am not here today to talk about whether golems did exist, did not exist, when they existed, how they existed. That's not our discussion today. How do you make them? That you have to come to Kabbalah 101, or maybe more advanced than 101.
It's actually
Rabbi Haven may be doing it in Boulder next week. You might have to smoke a few. So what I'd like to try to divide up our discussion into three over here, and that is, step one is just to ascertain what the status of an artificial intelligence, let's call it humanoid, I guess, would be. And second of all is, what would be the liability of the creator of such a robot? If that robot ran around and started wreaking havoc, would the creator be liable? And the third part of the discussion would be that, can we argue that a robot is no different than, say, my dog? Or, for those who are even slightly familiar with Talmudic discussion, the classic Talmudic case: if my ox goes and gores your cow, I'm liable if I didn't watch it properly. So, you know, in more modern terms, if my robot goes and smashes up your car, and we'll talk about why it would do that and so on, can I be liable for that as well? So those are the three areas I'd like to try to focus on. So let's start from the top over here, and that is, as Phil pointed out, the golem question. There's a passage in the Talmud in Sanhedrin that says that the great Talmudic sage Rava created a person. Person over here does not mean a human as we perceive it, but what's known as a golem. Okay, the classic idea of a golem is that, again, it's not our discussion today, I'm not getting deeply involved in it, but just the fact of the basic understanding is that one with appropriate knowledge of certain Kabbalistic secrets and so on can take Earth, form a human form, and give it some degree of life, if you will. It cannot speak or communicate, but it can follow instructions. And Rava created such a being and sent it before his colleague, Rabbi Zeira. Rabbi Zeira spoke to it, thinking it was a regular human, and it didn't answer. Upon which Rabbi Zeira realized this is not a human, but rather a creation of Rava, and he said, "You are a creation of my colleagues. Return to your dust." Okay, and again, I'm not getting involved in why is the Talmud telling us this. There are always deeper levels in these kinds of Talmudic passages. And just to take it superficially, not only is missing the point, in a sense, the travesty, because it's not here just for the superficial idea. But it does bring forth the idea that Rava, being a great Talmudic sage, was not concerned with murder by deposing of this golem, of this humanoid being. Even though it walked, didn't talk, but it walked around and seemingly had some degree of life in it, there was no issue of murder. So there's a responsa, from a great rabbi who lived in the 1700s. His name is known as the Chacham Tzvi, Rabbi Tzvi Ashkenazi. And he was asked about the question of whether or not such a being could be used as part of a minion. Okay, we only got nine. So one second, I went to Rabbi Haman's Kabbalah class last week. Give me a couple minutes. I'll be back with our 10th man thing. Let me just step out. And the question is, can you count such a being as the 10th man for the minion? So he says, he says obviously not, but some of what he says is relevant to our discussion. He says, if you think it has a purpose, this golem, insofar as it can combine to be part of 10 for a minion, for any matter of sanctity, because that's one, you need a quorum of 10 men is for areas of sanctity, of prayer, and so on, Rabbi Zeira would not have removed it from the world. For though there is no prohibition of murder, Okay? And then he continues, a fetus formed in the mother's womb would engender liability of murder. So two points he makes over here, and it's a little bit disjointed over here, so let me just explain what I quoted, because I skipped a whole bunch in the middle. He's making two points. Point number one is that Rabbi Zeira would not have just gotten rid of this golem if it served some useful purpose. If you ask me, being the 10th man for a minion is a very useful purpose. Comes in handy a lot of times, especially if you're not on the East Coast, you're in Denver, and this is the last minion in town, and you've got nine people. Having a golem around would be very useful. Just open the closet, you know, switch them on. Here we go. But so he said that's one argument that he cannot combine to a minion. But he also points out there's no issue of murder. He says because murder, taking of a human life, is only by a fetus formed in the mother's womb. Now I'll just put in a plug for next month. You can already see where this is going in terms of the cloning question, because a clone perhaps is not born. From a mother's womb, perhaps created in a test tube or in a laboratory, but you'll have to come back for next month to find out more about that. But the point is that he's making it very clear that if there's no birth at all, be it a mother's womb or otherwise, there's no sense, no status of a human at all, and therefore there would be no issue of taking away its life. Okay, I think we can obviously apply that even if you have Commander Data running around on your ship, and for those who don't get the reference, I'll explain later, and you want to turn him off or something to that effect, so there wouldn't be a problem because there's no human over here. So I think that establishes right off the bat that it's not considered a human being. And so by extension, an artificial intelligence would not be considered a human being either. So the question is now, what is it? What is it? It's not a human being. What it is, and I didn't discuss this over here, but what it is essentially my property, because it's a machine. And the same way we understand that my smartphone, or my desktop, or my car, or even my dog is my property, it belongs to me, by extension, even a very intelligent robot that looks, sounds, feels, comes across as being a human, is my property. Okay, to that end, as an aside, I can make it clean my entire house for Pesach if I wanted. I could, you know, have it do whatever I want because it belongs to me. The question becomes then, in as much as it's mine, what is my degree of responsibility for what it goes ahead and does? And I'd like to take this over here in two levels, because yeah, I think it's understood. If I take a gun and I fire a bullet, not me, someone else takes a gun and fires a bullet and kills somebody, he's liable even though the bullet killed him. No, the bullet did not kill him. The person killed him. I'm not getting involved in that debate now, but it's the bullet that killed the person. Through the action of the individual, he's liable. He's a murderer. He's liable to death. Where life gets more complicated, okay, if I take a rock and I toss it through your window and I shatter the window, it's not the rock that broke the window. It's me. I broke the window. I'm responsible because it's a direct, that's my power and my force going into the rock. I threw it directly. I pulled the trigger, and as a direct result, it directly fired the bullet. Yes, there's a bit of a mechanism in there with the gunpowder, but it's a direct outcropping of my action of pulling the trigger, and therefore I am fully responsible for whatever happens. The question becomes when it's not a direct outcropping of what I did, where it's indirect, where I set something in motion that ended up causing damage, and that is what ended up happening, but it's not a direct result, am I liable for that? Okay? Some of you may be familiar with Rube Goldberg. Anyone?
Rube Goldberg. Yep.
Okay? So if I create such a contraption, the Rube Goldberg-like device, when I was a kid, there was this game called Mousetrap. And, you know, so I push a button, and that activates that, bam, 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 bam. Finally, the ball falls down and smashes your priceless Ming-era vase. Am I liable for it or not? And here's a discussion in the Talmud. And here's the discussion in the Talmud, what's called grumma. Grumma means causing, causative. It's not direct. I caused the damage. And the baseline rule is that if I cause damage, but it's not a direct result of my action, I just caused it, in a court, a Jewish court of law, I cannot be held liable to pay for the damage. I am not held accountable directly for the murder. I'm not a full-fledged murderer who can be subject to capital punishment. There may be other penalties or issues involved. A grumma, the cause of damage, I may be liable in heaven, meaning heaven will hold me accountable for the damage caused, but a Jewish court of law down here on earth cannot say you have to pay this person for the damage you caused. That is the basic law. And there are a lot of cases that the Talmud talks about where I cause damage. Just one example. Let's say I take a coin and I toss it into a lake. And it's too deep to be easily retrieved, or you can hire divers to get it, but you have to pay for the divers, and you know. So, am I liable or not? Well, I didn't destroy the coin, I just put it out of reach. So in a sense, this is one classic case where I'm causing you a loss, but I didn't cause you direct damage. Okay, another case the Talmud talks about. Let's say a guy drops his item, a vessel, off a roof. He drops his glass off a roof, and it's going to smash on the floor, except there are pillows and cushions at the bottom. And those pillows and cushions will cushion the fall at the bottom. It's right there, yeah. And will prevent it from breaking. I'm a third party, I run in, I pull those cushions away. And now the glass smashes to the floor and shatters. Am I liable or not? I certainly did something that caused it to happen, but I didn't actually do any sort of act directly to it. That's another case. Okay? Or just a very basic case of grumas where I put a bunch of steps into action. I open the door, air comes in, air sets off a mechanism which causes an arrow to be fired that breaks your window. So you have multiple steps where it wasn't directly what I did. Would I be liable? All these cases are grumma. And in the case of grumma, as we'll see, there's a great deal of discussion whether you're liable or not. And with that, I will take you to source number 3. Source number 3 says, okay, the Talmud is talking to, there's a discussion in the Talmud about such a case, and the Talmud says, yeah, go ahead.
Grumma, you made it clear that that's not liable in a Bezdin.
It's not liable in a Bezdin, although I should say, let me add one disclaimer, there will be one opinion that holds you are liable. I'm going to touch on that shortly.
Okay.
But according to the vast majority of opinions, a grumma, where you cause it, you are not liable in a Jewish court of law. Correct.
That's the assumption we're going to.
That's the assumption. There'll be one opinion not like that. We'll see you shortly.
I'll defer to our scholars here, but in American tort law, the issue in these scenarios you're describing is foreseeability. Is the outcome likely to happen based on your action? Is it foreseeable that this would occur? Is that an element in grumma?
Yes.
So it seems to me if you're pulling the pillow, you see the glass come down and you yank the pillow.
So let's see. It's an element, and we'll see how much of an element it is. It is an element, but yeah. Okay. Now, let me just preface, one more preface before I go to the source. And that is that I am giving really a tip of the iceberg discussion. This is a huge discussion. Talmudic scholars spend months, years on this particular subject. There are infinite number of cases, details, opinions. The more you come down the pipeline from the Talmud, as you move further and further away through the commentators, it just branches out more and more and more in the different opinions, cases. One tweaks it this way, one tweaks it that way, and so it's really a huge discussion. We're just going to try to touch on some of the basics over here and try to get an idea of what the issues might be for our discussion. So the Talmud says that you are the one who says that it is Rabbi Meir, one of the sages of the Mishnah, who would judge a case of Garmi. More about that in a second. Doesn't that mean that it is Rabbi Meir and you don't rule like him? Meaning, Rabbi Meir would be the minority opinion against the opinion of the other sages, and therefore you would go like the other sages and you would not judge such a case? You cannot convict such a case? And this sage said, no, it is the opinion of Rabbi Meir, and I rule like him. Okay, and here the Talmud lays down that one of the later sages ruled in accordance with Rabbi Meir, who ruled in the case of Garmi. What is Garmi? I discussed an idea called Grumma. Grumma means causative. Garmi is a case where there's a higher level of my involvement in the damage. It's causative, but there's a higher level of involvement in what took place. That is what's called Garmi, according to most opinions. in the commentators. And there, even though normally grumma, where I cause something to happen, will be exempt, where you have a more direct involvement, a greater amount of involvement in the damage, that falls under a category called garmi, and Rabbi Meir would rule that in fact you could be liable in such a case, because even though you just caused it, it's not your direct action, but there's a higher level of involvement that would make you liable. Okay, now the question is, define it. Can you define garmi versus grumma? Grumma, you're exempt. Garmi, you're liable. We could define it, and we'll try just to see a little bit, because like, as I said, I think I saw five different opinions on what exactly garmi is. We'll try to just touch on a couple of them just to give an idea. And that brings us to source number four, where he says, we need to distinguish between all these cases from the law of garmi. And Rabbi Yitzchok, a medieval scholar, distinguished in one version that the law of garmi is when he himself does the damage to his fellow's money. Meaning, I went ahead and I performed an action on something that belongs to you, and although my action did not directly damage it, I was the cause of damage. So going back to the case I mentioned earlier, I take your coin and I toss it into the lake. I didn't ruin the money, it's still there, but it's inaccessible. It's basically useless to you. But it was my direct action that caused a step two that now you can't access it. It's a cause of damage. I didn't destroy the money, I just rendered it inaccessible. But you would be liable in such a case because I am the one who did the action to the money. I took the money, I threw it into the lake, I would be liable. That's one step. Step two, he further distinguished that the law of garmi, that is liable, is only if the damage came at the time of the act. Okay, now this touches a little bit on what Danny mentioned, that it's what you would call foreseeable. This is not exactly foreseeable, rather means it would mean that the damage happens immediately. How you define immediately, 2 seconds, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, it depends who you ask. Okay, but it has to happen within a very relatively immediate amount of time following whatever action I did. So if I put a series of events in motion, let's just take it to the artificial intelligence discussion. If I program the robot to go rob a bank, let's just say, okay, and I say, go rob the bank, and this robot figures out the best way to rob the bank and you know, puts on the appropriate masks and covers the appropriate cameras and sets up the appropriate getaway car, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, goes in and robs the bank and it gets away. Am I accountable for that? Or not? Well, on the one hand, I set it in motion, but it's not a direct, immediate result. The robot has to go learn. It goes and studies. It Googles all past bank robberies to see exactly how to rob a bank. You'll have to expand on this because I don't really know how to program a robot to rob a bank, although Rabbi Shmuel might be a fundraising idea. But but it's not immediate. It's not immediate. So based on the second criteria, I wouldn't necessarily be directly liable for creating such a robot. Whereas on the first one also, he himself does the damage to his fellow's money. I didn't do it myself. I just created this entity that's going to go do it on my behalf. I wouldn't be liable either.
So self-driving cars, another form of artificial intelligence, this is directly on point.
Correct. Yes. The self-driving car would be that question as well. Yeah, and I spoke to a rabbi who's an expert in areas of halacha and monetary law in Lakewood, New Jersey, and he told me, he said, look, I can only talk to you about the basic points over here because these questions haven't come up practically yet to the authorities, but one of the ideas he did invoke was the idea of the self-driving car. Because I'm not driving it directly. If I drive my car in someone else's car, I'm liable. I drove directly into the car. I'm the one driving the car. But if it's a self-driving car and I just messed up in the programming or it's and so on, I wouldn't necessarily be liable because it doesn't necessarily meet these criteria. However, there's a third opinion, a second opinion over here. Okay, and that is, as if you continue in source 4, another very important opinion. It appears to the Ritzbah, that's an acronym for a longer name that I'm not actually sure what that longer name is, but it's Rabbi something, I can tell you that the law of Garmi is predicated upon a penalty. And therefore, all damage that is available and commonly occurs, the sages penalized him. Now, this is an entirely different look. The Ritzbah's approach is that really, Garmi and Grumma from the baseline biblical laws of jurisprudence, Jewish jurisprudence, There's no difference. Garmi is grumma, it's causative, you're exempt. Garmi is defined as any case where people could take advantage when they want to get somebody and just be off the hook, so they have ways of causing damage to this person and getting away with it because they say, well, it wasn't me, it was the grumma, it was causative, I'm exempt. And so the sages took a number of cases that are discussed in the Talmud and said, all these cases you are liable for, not because based on the technical law you should be liable, we are instituting an enactment necessary for the basic running of civil society, that we can't have people who have vendettas running around damaging people and getting away with it scot-free. So any case where the sages determined there should be a penalty in place as a deterrent slash penalty in the case the person does it, that's included in Garmi, which means there's no real criteria in terms of defining it, accepting what the sages determine is included or not. So I asked this rabbi when I spoke to him, I said, well, does that mean any future situation which is determined by a Jewish court of law to be something which is very relevant and common and available is automatically included, or is it only the cases discussed in the Talmud? And what he seemed to indicate was, no, it's only the cases discussed in the Talmud. I said, okay, so robot, I could just go make a robot and have it, you know, I have a vendetta with my next door neighbor, so I'll just have my robot go next door and smash out his windows, pop all his tires, and I'm off the hook. So he said there are other tools available to a modern Jewish court of law by which they can create an enactment, he didn't elaborate, by which they can enact a penalty for someone who is pulling off this kind of shtick if it's necessary. So kind of included in the enactment of the Ritzbah, this idea that the Ritzbah is putting forth, that Garmi is an enactment, would be that even a modern Jewish court of law has the ability to put other things kind of into this category and find the person liable when they deem it necessary for the public good.
Can I just add something real quick? So, or it's as much a question as anything, but you know, one of the things that I think is really interesting in this kind of environment is, you know, where a lot of, so there's, in the world of artificial intelligence, there's also a developing world of kind of the people who are looking into kind of the future ethics involved in what artificial intelligence means. And one of the things that's been, you know, one of the things that clearly comes up a lot, and I think is relevant to this, is so you're sort of assuming all these cases where the person has intent to do something wrong, but they've programmed some intermediate actor to do it on their behalf. But, you know, what if instead of the go rob a bank, I program a robot to say money is good? And, you know, my intention is, you know, you look at stock trades and you decide which ones are more likely to have a good outcome than others. But over time, the robot says, and we talked about this a little bit, the robot says, well, that seems silly. Why don't I just go rob a bank? And so, right, so you haven't intended to do that, but you didn't have the foresight really to limit that fitness function, if you will. So, you know, is there? It sounds like that's way beyond where Garmi has gone. But
so okay. So thank you very much for bringing up that point, because I didn't want to discuss it, and I would have forgotten if you wouldn't have mentioned it. In general, when it comes to laws of damages, the basic rule is the way the Talmud lays it down is that man is always regarded as a damager. Meaning, it doesn't matter if you're awake, sleeping, by mistake, and so on. In virtually, not all, but in the vast majority of cases, assuming that there was some degree of avoidability where you could have been a little more careful and avoided the damage, even if it was unintentional, you're liable. Okay? And so now the question becomes, by Garmi, is that also true? Is Garmi, which is causative, is that also liable for unintentional damage? Certainly we have to ask that question according to the opinion of the Ritzbah, where it's a penalty to maintain civil society. Does it include unintentional as well? It does seem from the sources that I saw that it's included, even unintentional damage is included as well. Okay, even if it's a penalty. Once they enacted and they said Garmi is liable, okay, and these cases are included, it wouldn't make a difference whether it's intentional or unintentional. And so in the case that we discussed where I programmed my robot, money is good, and so it ends up robbing people to get that money or carrying out other illegal activities, if damage is caused, I would be liable for that. even though that was not the intent of my actions, that it engaged in illegal or damaging activities. Because at the end of the day, there's an issue of cause over here. But again, it would have to fall under the rubric of Garmi. So, assuming it is Garmi, then I would be liable even if I just said money's good and I didn't say go rob the bank. If it's not included in Garmi, then it's just regular causative. And if it's regular causative, Grumma, I would be exempt, even though I set this in motion.
What happens when robot says no?
Huh?
What happens
when the robot says no? I don't know.
Well, so this
but
gets to
not, yeah.
Usually it's going to happen at two levels: the manufacturer and the user. And the manufacturer is going to design robots with constraints. And one of the questions is a design constraint that robots say no to things?
So what if it's thinking on its own, it says no?
It has to be designed so it can do that. So if it's...
What if it has a soul? It comes out with a soul.
It can't come out with a soul. Only.
What if it develops a soul and it...
So that's why I kind of started with that premise question at the beginning of saying we're just assuming for the purposes of this discussion that is
right.
Not an option.
Well, right. from a Jewish standpoint, from a Torah standpoint, certainly only God can bestow a soul, and I'm not familiar with God bestowing souls on computers yet. As far as I know, in fact, my experience is most computers are rather soulless.
So this is a you didn't want to go here?
We didn't.
Right. That was,
so I will just footnote and say a great Phil Dick story called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep became the movie Blade Runner, which plays with this idea. And there are other movies that play with this idea. It's a different topic, but it's a really when the line between human and robot becomes harder to discern. It's a great topic, but I guess we're not going there today.
We're not going there today.
But I think get back to the point I was going is when the person designs the robot, when does the designer have liability versus the
right.
user?
Right. So those are the questions which, as I said, when I spoke to this rabbi, he said there are so many details until the questions actually come up practically, it's hard to know which way they'll go.
I just want to bring up that I think with your discussion, the whole first part of your, and it's taking quite a bit of time, but the whole first part of your presentation is talking about the liability of a human as damages of a human as being directly connected to the designer, owner, the person who put it in motion. But there's a whole other thing which I see in your next thing,
yes.
that which is probably more relevant to this, that when you have an ownership over something which has a potential to damage.
Absolutely. I think both are very relevant. But yes, I do want to get to the second point. Before I get to the second point, I just want to make one more point in number five. I'm not going to go through the whole thing inside, but Maimonides, the Rambam, is of the opinion that in fact there is no difference between Grumma and Garmi. There are two terms that mean the same thing. And in fact, he understands that according to the opinion of the aforementioned Rabbi Meir, who would rule Garmi, that's just another way of saying he would hold you liable for causative damages. And therefore, the Rambam would say that for causative damages, you would be liable regardless. And of course, now the question becomes, where do you draw the line that's called causative, as opposed to it's not coming from me at all? Okay, this is the question. Who would you hold at fault if the designer failed to put a moral compass, let's just say, into our robot? Or so am I liable because I bought it and I flipped the switch, but I didn't know it has no moral compass. So maybe the designer's liable, but he didn't turn it on. I turned it on, so maybe I should be liable, but I don't know. So here you get into nitty-gritty questions, which there are precedents for these kinds of questions when you have multiple parties contributing to a bad situation, who is liable, if anybody. And that's where these things get tricky, and as the cases come up, hopefully the robbing the bank scenario won't, but as these cases come up, perhaps with the self-driving cars and so on, so I bought the car, but Toyota finally admitted that it was a faulty switch that they put in for which the car doesn't run well. Who's at fault? Me, the guy for turning it on, or Toyota for not programming it properly? These are the questions that are going to come up.
It was GM.
Don't
matter what GM
says. Actually, today it's Volkswagen.
That's right. Okay. That brings us to the last part of our discussion, which Rabbi Schwab alluded to, and that is the idea of being responsible for damage that my property does. And the very first Mishnah in Tractate Bava Kamma says there are four primary damagers: the bull, the pit, the maveh. Maveh, there are different opinions what that means. I'm not going to get involved in that right now. What is relevant to us is fire. Okay, and the reason why that's relevant to us is because of how the Talmud defines fire. Because it's not just fire or bull or pit. It's a bull is an animal which has the force of life and can go and cause damage based on the force of life. So that would mean my dog as well. That would mean my sheep, etc., etc. I would be liable for that. So there are subcategories. A pit means anything which is a something from which people can trip on, fall into, etc., etc. So it's not limited to a hole in the ground. If I leave a rock in the middle of the street and a car blows its tires out on it, or some glass, that may be the same category. It's something which is stationary and causing damage. What's relevant to us is fire, because the Talmud defines it as follows. What are the subcategories of fire? If you will say a person's stone, knife, or burden, which he placed on top of his roof, and they fell down in a normal wind and caused damage, what are the circumstances? If they damaged as they were moving, that's fire. What distinguishes fire? That there's another force mixed in with it. It's your property, and the responsibility of watching it is upon you. These two, another force mixed in with it, it's your property, and you are responsible to watch it. The Talmud talks about a case where I left an item of mine precariously perched on a rooftop, and an average wind came along and knocked it off, and it bonked someone on the head and caused damage, or any other thing you can think of. So I am liable. Why? Because just as I am responsible, if I light a fire, so I could say, I wash my hands of the fire. It's not my fire. It needed the wind to carry the fire, to go burn half the block down. So we say, and the Torah says, no, it's your fire, because you lit it, or you own the fire, and you have to expect, and this is where you talk about foreseeable expectations, it's reasonable that if it can, with a normal wind, jump and cause damage, then you are going to be responsible for it. And by extension, if you leave an item precariously perched on the roof, and it's normal to expect it to fall down and potentially cause damage, it's exactly the same thing. It needs another force mixed in to go and cause damage, and that's what happened, you would be liable. And I think when we talk about robots, this is really the biggest area where you can, an owner or a creator of artificial intelligence, be it a robot or for that matter a computer, just manipulating stock prices and things like that, where there's potential liability for the owner. Because you have this thing, you flip on, you mix in, you let some electricity or whatever's powering it, power it, that's another force, and there it goes. And it doesn't need you anymore. Right, it just goes off on its own. So that mimics this damager called fire, and potentially you would be liable. So going back to our self-driven cars, where I'm not touching it, I didn't do anything. Well, you turn the ignition, there it goes. So there's another power mixed in. You created it, you own it. You could potentially be liable if we can argue, as Danny pointed out, that it's foreseeable and something that you have to expect. Because one of the points the Talmud uses in the discussion of fire is that the case of the knife and the burden of the fire is that a normal wind came along and knocked it off the roof. And the reason why the Talmud points out a normal wind is because you're only liable for something which is within the realm of normalcy. So if you're not expecting a strong wind to come, and then suddenly a strong wind comes and knocks that thing off the roof, or a strong wind comes and that gives the force for the fire needs to jump to the next combustible item, I was not expected necessarily to anticipate that, and therefore I wouldn't necessarily be liable. Okay, and that really would become where all the nitty-gritty questions would come in. I'm going ahead and I'm programming this machine. Money's good. Do I have to expect that it's going to rob a bank? That it's going to play around with it, with try to manipulate stock prices on the market? I have no idea. I'll let you two answer that question. But if that's something which needs to be reasonably expected, then there may be good grounds that the creator, or perhaps the one who turns on the machine, if he knows what's involved, and sets it in motion, may be responsible for the damage caused by that artificial intelligence, even though it's 10 steps later. It takes a week for it to happen. It takes months for it to happen. Okay, but because it can be reasonably expected, there would be liability. Just to throw one more monkey wrench, and with that I will end. And that is, this rabbi who I spoke to said there is an opinion that says the following: there's a case of what's called the oven. Okay, if I light a small fire inside my house and it'll burn out in about 20 minutes, and there's no reasonable expectation that it's going to cause any damage due to its heat to any of the surrounding area. So then if it ends up doing that, and for the 20 minutes it burned, I didn't have to expect that, I'm exempt. He says, but let's say I have an oven. This oven is going to burn day and night. At any given moment, statistically, there's no expectation it's going to cause any damage beyond its own 4 cubits. Okay, beyond the space that it takes up. But over time, statistically, the odds of it causing damage increase because it's an oven. It's here all the time. It's always lit. It's always burning. So sooner or later, something may well go awry. So in each moment, you say, is there an expectation? No. But over the course of a week, a month, a year, 10 years, will something happen? Very possibly. Is that included in reasonable expectation? So if I say, at any given moment, will a self-driven car get itself into an accident? No, because most of the time, I'm assuming by the time that they actually let them go on the roads, they will be far better than humans. They're not going to be texting while driving, or busy with a phone call, etc., etc., etc. And the fact that the windshield wipers are not working are not going to make that much of a difference, I assume. But statistically, is there an expectation that there may be an error? Do you have a responsibility to make sure it's programmed absolutely perfectly? How far does that go? Would go into this question. At any given moment, it's better than a human. But over time, due to faulty programming perhaps, errors may occur. What's the degree of liability? That would go into this discussion as well, as far as reasonable expectation.
Question. You mentioned about the manufacturer who programs something and has safeguards about how far. In Talmud, I'm just curious. We define responsibility almost by ownership. So the person that lit the fire, where do you see anywhere in Talmud that you're responsible to? Does it make a difference that the manufacturer or something, by not expressing the danger, for example, a fire? But if I give you a fire, sell you a fire, if I sell you a cow, even if I didn't tell you that this bull is pretty wild, but the fire can burn, you're not responsible. So what's the Thomas? The seller. The person that sells it. Ownership takes responsibility. It's not true by sales it by this type of thing. You could get back to the manufacturer.
So is that true in Jewish law? The secular version is caveat emptor, which means buyer beware. Yeah. Once a sale happens, the manufacturer / seller has no potential liability, or are there situations they're still liable?
I think it depends. It would depend on the situation. So you're right. In a situation, for example, where let's say you have a bull, okay,
and the Talmud, court three times.
Right. So you have the classic case. I'll just try to very quickly give. We're almost out of time here, but it's very, very quickly. The background is that normally a bull is not expected to gore, and therefore you're not expected to guard it to the extent that it cannot go and gore others and cause that kind of damage. If it occurs three times under certain circumstances, now you have to expect that it's going to happen. It's called in Talmudic terms a muad. It means now it's established as a violent animal, and it needs a higher degree of watching. So let's say I sell you that kind of animal, it's already established, and I know that it's a muad, I know that it's already established, and I don't tell you that, and I sell it to you, I'm not sure. There are cases of discussion. There are cases of discussion like that.
The question here is holding back.
That's holding back. Okay.
The question here would be...
But it's a level of irresponsibility on behalf of the seller. He's giving something to the buyer where the buyer is not aware. Doesn't matter that he's deliberately...
Well, so this is a good topic for another day, which is latent defects, which is a defect that's latent. The maker may or may not know of it, but maybe they should have known about it. Once they sell it, are they still potentially responsible? Neil will give you the last question.
Well, I mean, I'm almost going around in circles here about in terms of responsibility and liability. It seems like there's so many different gradations can arise. I'm always brought back to the Torah itself when we talk about sacrifices and offering ways to rectify behavior. And we go back to where it's more important to be concerned with inadvertent sins, inadvertent mistakes versus ones that were avert, in other words, the way you actually had some intention. So the inadvertent ones where you had no intention at all, and yet this domino thing happened as a result of it, the Torah seems to be telling me that you have some liability there, that you have to be paying attention to consequences all of the time. And
absolutely. You're absolutely correct. What you're mentioning is, as I mentioned at the outset, that even a grum, a causative damage, where I'm exempt in a human court of law, but as far as heaven is concerned, I have a responsibility to make it right. So, you know, after that individual moves on to the next world, he's going to be held accountable for that as any other sin between man and fellow man. So in other words, it's no different than slandering his fellow man. He's accountable, but no human court of law can, well, a human court of law can't necessarily do anything. So by this is the same thing.
Don't these later cases pretty much get rid of Garmi and Groma? I mean, once we get to Rambam, aren't we pretty much saying, no, we're going to look at a situation, and if this is what's going to happen from your action, you're liable. And it seems like, you know, it pretty much undoes the former ruling.
So yes, that...
Which one?
Five. I think you're referring to five.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you are correct. As I mentioned, the Rambam, as well as Rashi also, they're of the opinion that all causative damage is liable. But he's not, but that's his opinion. So the question now becomes, how do we rule? Yeah, whom do we follow? If you look in the Jewish code of law, there are two opinions. If you look in the commentators, there's about one line of Shulchan Aruch of Code of Jewish Law, and then the great commentator, the Shach, Rabbi Shavasi Cohen, who wrote a commentary on the side, he said, I wanted to write a separate work on this, but he gives a few reasons why he didn't, but I want to speak briefly. And he has about six pages of small type right afterwards where he discusses it, where he speaks briefly about the question. So it's a lot, as I say, this is just the tip of the iceberg. There are different opinions as to whether causative damage is liable or just cases of Garmi, which is source four.
Whoever the could be four different people. They have different people. It could 100% depends on them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nothing to do with anything else but their opinions.
Their opinions will be predicated on these earlier sources.
They have a different opinion.
Well, that's the Jewish way.
So
but yeah.
Six opinions.
What have you accomplished?
Well, if you're in a Jewish court of law, you would go after the majority opinion of whether he's liable or not.
It could be you three could have an opinion, and then the three over here will give me another.
You're right, but that's if you go. But if you go to a court, the court's decision is binding.
What if we grant our artificial intelligence?
No, but
actually, this is a good note to end on, which is at some point, the argument would be not only have artificial intelligence writing news stories, but judging cases, and we are getting closer to that possibility, which we should remain scared about. But in a great note to end on,
someone judges out there, not so bad.
There you go. The teaching I heard is on the Maharal is we don't know whether or not he made a golem, but he could have made a golem. So, thank you, Robert. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Yeah.
4 hours is being generous. It's probably a lot more than that. Actually, it's clear in the Talmud that you need a human male adult to be a judge in the court of law.
Who has children.
Not children cannot.
No. The person has to have children.
Oh, he has children. So there are criteria.
Right.